Tanya, the woman I had met just twice before, was standing there across the room. If she had been wearing wings and a halo, it wouldn't have been more obvious. She was my sign. She was my roadblock. I put the drink back down on the bar before I took that first sip, and I haven't had one since. I knew from that moment on that Tanya and I would be together forever. There was only one problem. She didn't. Yeah, Tanya's smarter than I am, believe it or not, way smarter than I am. I know, shocker. Shocker. She understood that unless we shared a common faith, unless we had something deep, meaningful, and spiritual to help guide us and bind us, we'd never make it. And quite honestly, that all sounded reasonable to me. You know, because basically I just wanted to have sex. So honestly, I would have agreed to just about anything. You want me to amputate my right index finger right here in front of you with this dull butter knife? Okay, here goes. Can we have sex now? No. Okay. How about after the bleeding stops? But an amazing thing happened as Tanya and I had our church tour. We went from church to church shopping for a faith. I started to enjoy it. The more we looked, the more sense her plan made. And now, years later, our commitment to God has strengthened our commitment to each other. Our faith sustains us. And I'll admit it right now. Hello, my name is Glenn, and I'm addicted to God. Now, I'm not saying that religion is the key to happy and successful marriages, but I'm not saying it either. Being dedicated to something bigger than each other has worked for us, but that doesn't mean it's the right answer for you. The key is finding out what is, and then devoting your lives together to it. And caveat here, drugs, alcohol, porn, and gambling don't count. I mean, I checked on the first marriage. The next phase of the circle of life? Porn.
I never thought these stories were true. I never thought I'd be writing a letter like this. If it hadn't happened to me, I never would have believed it was possible.
I'm getting ahead of myself. First, let me start here. I dig chicks. I do. I dig chicks, especially hot ones who aren't wearing much in the way of clothing. You know what I'm saying? But then again, I'm pretty sure almost all guys do. It's kind of hardwired into our DNA. Being attracted to the female form is part of God's grand design. I believe God set it up that way, you know, so we'd keep making people. And if we can't have sex for one reason or another, most guys will gladly watch someone else have sex. As I said earlier, I'm no saint. I saw plenty of porn back when my day-to-day life made Robert Downey Jr. look like a Boy Scout, and way before the internet porn boom. However, from what I hear, it's now amazingly easy to find adult content by which at, oh, let's say, 2 o'clock in the morning, when sleep is elusive, a man can point and click his way down the rabbit hole to far-off lands like Amsterdam or exotic Thailand, where good taste and the law of physics just doesn't seem to apply anymore. I've actually heard that you can see things online that would make Bill Clinton and R. Kelly blush. The porn industry generates billions of dollars every year. One study pins the number at as much as $97 billion worldwide and $13 billion here in the United States. Now, if that's true, these companies don't exactly file SEC statements, so not really easy to audit. But if it's true, porn earns more each year, you ready to have your mind blown? Then Microsoft, Google, Amazon, eBay, Yahoo, Apple, Netflix, and Earthlink combined. Mind still not blown? Based only on U.S. earnings, porn makes more than Major League Baseball, the NHL, the NFL, plus the combined revenues of ABC, CBS, and NBC. Now, I know what you're thinking. Gee, how can I get my hands on some of that sweet porn profit, huh?
Stop! Just because $3,075.64 is being spent on porn each and every second doesn't mean it's a good thing.
I know.
I know, for an avowed capitalist like me, hard to believe.
But I do.
Just because porn is ready, willing, and able to send you through the looking glass to the darkest side of yourself for an extremely reasonable price, or, you know, so I hear, that doesn't mean you should take the trip. In the immortal words of the woman voted least likely to be referenced in a passage about hot chicks, you gotta just say no to porn. If you'll pardon the crude imagery, porn's a slippery slope, you know what I'm saying? I've had guys tell me, hey, what's the big deal? I mean, porn is something that my wife and I enjoy together.
Yeah,
that's a big load of crap. When I used to look at porn, the last thing I wanted was for my wife to know what I was doing. But even if your wife does watch porn with you, loser, how do you think she'd feel about the unlimited porn-on-demand package that you bought at some seedy hotel on your last business trip? Wait, you didn't actually think she'd believe that a movie starring Reese Witherspoon cost you $24.99, did you? Oh, wait, you didn't tell her about the little purchase? Of course not, because porn breeds secrets, and secrets destroy marriages. And you know what? We don't learn anything from pornography. It's sexual miseducation and reinforces the absolute worst notions that exist about men, women, and how we express ourselves in that wink-wink way. Yes, believe it or not, medical term. But porn is dangerous in another way as well. Respect for women, or should I say lack of respect. Guys are always talking tough about protecting their mom. That's my mama you're talking about, and sisters and daughters. But who do you think the women are on IFeelNaughty.com? They're somebody's sister, daughter, and yes, even though it's a total buzzkill, often somebody's mommy. If we're going to protect, respect, and cherish the women in our lives, paying $39.99 that will automatically be billed to our credit cards as Fun Time Industries so we can see bad girls who get what they deserve while dressed as characters from The Wizard of Oz, hypothetically speaking, of course, is not the way to do it. It's not only destructive, it's hypocritical as well. Porn is one of this life's most readily available distractions. It celebrates our basest instincts and turns classless women like Paris Hilton into celebrities. Believe me, when I can't sleep, I sometimes think about taking that trip down the rabbit hole myself, but I don't. It may not sound like much, but I can tell you, self-control does have its own rewards, not the least of which is a happy, healthy marriage. ADD moment. Plus, your email inbox, a lot less scary. Even though it seems like a really great deal, I don't really want to read a message about the Maximizer that sells for just $69.69 from some web store in Bangkok. I hate to be the one that breaks it to you, ladies, but a recent study determined that men who buy and watch pornography are more likely to cheat on you.
No!
Yes. And that brings us to the third stage in our circle, adultery. Is looking at porn the same as reenacting it with that hottie from marketing down the hall? Of course not. But turning your attention outside your marriage is always a bad idea. Unlike a lot of other things that society has only recently decided are a bad idea, i.e. smoking on airplanes, carbs, fossil fuels, and sitcoms starring former cast members of Friends, strangely enough, adultery has been frowned upon since the thrilling days of yesteryear, when
thou shalt not covet thy neighbor's wife
was the hot new catchphrase. Having moments of weakness and confusion in marriage is natural. Anyone who tells you otherwise is breaking another classic rule.
Thou shalt not lie.
But betraying your spouse's trust is something I believe you will always regret. And my lawyer seems to agree, quite frankly. If you really must pursue interests outside your marriage, then maybe you should consider the final stop on our Circle of Life tour. Bing!
Now arriving, divorce.
Family is fundamental throughout nature. It is a unifying system that lends order to the world all around us. But it's under attack. The cynics who run rampant through our popular culture would like you to believe that marriage and the traditional family just don't work anymore, that the chances of staying married are about the same as a coin toss, 50-50. You've heard that stat, right? 50% of all marriages, you know, end in divorce. Well, I got news for you. They're wrong. For most people, that stat is a lie. The 50% divorce rate gets quoted an awful lot because it's sensational and shocking. Fortunately, it's not really true unless you meet very specific criteria. According to the annual State of Our Unions marriage study, here are some of the factors that decrease your risk of divorce within the first 10 years of marriage. First, annual income. If you make more than $50,000 a year, your odds of divorce are 30% lower than those making less than $25,000 a year. Waiting for marriage. If you wait until you're 25 years old to marry, your odds of divorcing are 24% less than someone who marries at the age of 18 or younger. Next is waiting for children. If you wait until you've been married for at least 7 months before having kids, your odds of divorce decrease 24% versus a couple having a child before marriage. Family history. If your parents are married, you're 14% more likely to stay together than if your parents have divorced. Religion. If you practice a faith, you're 14% more likely to stay married than if you don't. Education. If you've attended college, even for a day, your odds of divorce decrease 13% as opposed to a high school dropout. And the last one, not really in the official study, but if you're an idiot named Glenn who has already made a shambles of their life once and somehow or another you were given another chance with a woman who really, I think, pities you enough to marry you, chances of divorce, absolute zero. The study summarizes all of these statistics pretty nicely. Well, except for the last one, by saying, if you are a reasonably well-educated person with a decent income, come from an intact family, are religious, marry after the age of 25 without having a baby first, your chances of divorce are very low indeed. Even if you just meet a few of the criteria, your odds of divorce are still a lot lower than the nationally advertised 50% rate. But you never hear that, do you? It's because it just doesn't sell as many newspapers or magazines. I'm just hoping it'll sell a lot of books. But nobody wants to restart their life after their relationship crashes. But sometimes, it's the only thing that can get your life up and running again. America is a young and aggressive country. We're quick to let go of old traditions in the pursuit of the next big thing. That attitude applies to just about everything from fashion to music to, yes, even marriage. It's a shame. There's something to be said for perseverance and loyalty to both principles and people. At this point in my life, I don't believe in divorce. I know, it's easy for me to say now, but it comes from the understanding that if we all went into marriages with clearer heads, I don't think we'd be looking to get out of them quite so often. Divorce itself isn't a problem. Bad marriages are. That's why the only way to solve divorce is to make sure that marriage has every chance to succeed. So, instead of a solution, let me just say this. If you have kids, divorce is going to hurt them the most. I've seen it firsthand. Even under the friendliest of splits, divorce makes raising children difficult. To say the least. I mean, honestly, you can ask Alec Baldwin. Think about that before you call a lawyer and start divvying up the silverware. But there is a big but, and not just on Rosie O'Donnell. That was unkind, really, wasn't it? Jesus wouldn't have made that Rosie O'Donnell joke, but then again, Jesus isn't reading this book, is he? Raising children, and here's the but, in an abusive environment is even a worse alternative. While we can all agree that physical abuse is never acceptable, I've spoken to women who would have preferred that to the years of psychological abuse they've lived with during their marriages. No one should be living under abusive conditions. And in that case, I do support the decision to get divorced, and maybe start the whole cycle all over again. I wish the issues surrounding the beginning and ending of relationships were as easy to solve as, oh, let's say global warming. Al Gore and China's coal plants are easy. The human heart? Not so much. But if we used our heads while following our hearts, and maybe with just a little help from our faith, I think we may have a better chance. After all, I tricked not one but two women into marrying me. Section 3. Radical Islam. Politically incorrect. Sarah Peake, a Massachusetts select woman, sitting in a Provincetown meeting in November 2005, and something was bothering her. It wasn't the bad coffee or the stale pastries or her fellow council members droning on and on. What was bothering Mrs. Peake on this particular day was a painting that depicted the pilgrims voting on the Mayflower Compact that was hanging there on the wall. There were no women in it. And the only Native American in the painting didn't have a ballot in his hand. The thought that history would be represented in such a sexist, racist way, even though it was historically accurate, infuriated Ms. Peake, and she asked that the painting be removed. The council voted, and this being Massachusetts, 3 out of 4 people said they agreed with Ms. Peake. The painting came down. Was this political correctness gone haywire? Absolutely. But it is literally just the tip of the iceberg in terms of what we'll do to keep people comfortable and appeased, no matter the consequences. This politically correct, don't offend anyone mentality has turned into the Islamic extremists' most powerful weapon. Because I mention Islam and extremist in the same sentence, let me stop right here. My stance on Islam has been so twisted and mangled and misrepresented that my wife probably thinks I'm an intolerant hate monger. So let me be clear, once and for all. I've read the Quran. I can tell you that unequivocally, I believe that Islam is a religion of peace. The overwhelming majority, I believe that to be at least 90% of all Muslims, are good, peace-loving people. Immediately after September 11th, 2001, listeners began calling my radio show demanding guilt by association for average Muslims. I begged them not to overreact and explained that the people they wanted to vilify were likely just as shocked and saddened by what happened as they were. Because I personally witnessed how quickly fear can make good, rational people overreact, I spent years begging moderate Muslims to stand up, denounce the monsters who had perverted their religion. Although some have spoken out, it's clear to me that the radicals' plan to use fear and intimidation is working. They have shown that they are more than willing to kill anyone, including other Muslims, who don't share their beliefs, and that has left many moderate Muslims living in fear. Muslims are not the enemy. Extremists who want to destroy democracy and create Islamist states all over the world are the enemy. Political correctness usually goes only so far as to be a minor annoyance, like taking the baby Jesus out of the nativity scene, or, as the previous case with the painting, completely ignoring historical facts for the sake of someone's precious feelings. Well, you know what? I got feelings, too. And they're telling me our society is slowly going to hell and insane. Have you ever noticed the fuzzy logic that goes on when Islam is involved? I'm not a Muslim theologist, but I am a thinker. And all the incidents that have happened over the last few years don't seem to be all that equitable. Jesus figure soaked in urine. Okay. Quran in the toilet. Not okay. Elephant poop on the Virgin Mary. Okay. Newspaper cartoon of Mohammed. Not okay. Calling the President of the United States a terrorist. Okay. Suggesting that some Muslims might be terrorists. Not okay. Do you really think that Islamic extremists care
About our stupid little debates over how to avoid hurt feelings? Of course not. They welcome this walk on eggshells atmosphere we've created because it's an integral part of how they intend to get close enough to kill us. Islamic extremists understand that our greatest strength, our freedoms, is also our greatest weakness. We hold our freedoms and the document that defines them, the U.S. Constitution, above almost everything else. But newsflash, the radical Islamists don't. They're disgusted by Western values such as freedom, democracy, or the thought of women being equal to men because their lives are governed by their religion, which has very strict notions of how society should be structured. Although, I have to admit that some of these notions, such as banning television shows from featuring, "Surprise, I have four children with three different women and a cocker spaniel," aren't half bad. Most Muslims have a private spiritual life and are happy to live in a country where they can practice their faith freely and openly. But extremists don't want a private spiritual life. They want a political system that makes faith a very public, state-oriented system. I didn't get it at first, but now I do. It's about politics, not religion. In the world of Islamic extremism, there is no separation of mosque and state because their church is their state. Their religious leaders are their political leaders. And those leaders are more than happy to give you a simple choice: live under Islamic rule or die. A lot of people try to make the motivation behind radical Islamists extremely complicated. It's not. They simply believe that Islamic law surpasses every other law in society, including our precious little constitution, and they believe that everybody in the world should live under it. The basis of Islamic law, called Sharia, is not an actual set of laws, but rather a system of making them based on the interpretations of religious leaders. But these aren't the Roman Catholic types of interpretations, such as eat fish on Friday, or Scientologist-type interpretations, such as you must be an action movie star. These are pronouncements that encompass every aspect of life: marriage, divorce, eating, drinking, justice, finance, everything you can think of. Although it can be interpreted in many different ways, restriction and punishment are common elements of Sharia law, as followed by extremists. An eye for an eye. Drinkers and gamblers must be whipped. Homosexuals must be put to death. Adulterers must be stoned to death. Men can hit their women if they want to. If you say something negative about Islam, you can be put to death. Like Elvis bringing rock and roll into the mainstream, the Taliban, or more accurately, the collapse of the Taliban, helped shed light on how extreme Sharia law can be. They banned kite flying. They prevented women from going to school. They outlawed music. Yeah, sorry, Elvis, that means you. ADD moment. It would also mean banning rap, opera, and that lady who sings My Humps. Maybe it's not so bad. The Taliban also mandated that women have to have a male escort when leaving the house, and that anyone who converted from Islam to another religion must be executed. But at least you got to pick: Islamic fundamentalism or death. I mean, who knew the Taliban was pro-choice? The infiltration of radicals into America is slow. It's a gradual process. Most of us don't see it, or maybe it's that we choose to ignore it. The reality of the situation quickly becomes clear when jetliners plummet out of the sky at 600 miles an hour. Unfortunately, if you haven't noticed, just a few years after the biggest terrorist attack ever to hit American soil, we all seem to be asleep again. So it's time to wake us up. I'd like to introduce you to Exhibit A on what happens when a whole buttload of people take Ambien all at once. It's called Western Europe. An estimated 25 million Muslims currently live in Western Europe, and there is a great,
if not well-publicized, struggle happening over how to integrate them into Western culture. But there's one big problem. They're not integrating. They're not even being asked to. By using words such as diversity and multiculturalism and lodging charges of racism and hate-mongerism, okay, I think I made that last word up, over the heads of anyone who disagrees, European elites are allowing some Muslims to make their own laws, even if they trump their own. These Muslim fundamentalists take advantage of their freedoms in those countries by creating communities within communities and then insisting that they be governed by Sharia law. Their argument is intuitively simple. Hey, if this is a free society, man, then shouldn't I be able to practice my religion the way I'm used to? Yeah. Cute little defense, freak boy, but Jeffrey Dahmer was used to chopping people up and then eating them. Are you saying we're supposed to let him keep doing it? Of course not. Freedom of religion, speech, everything else always has one major caveat. They're all subject to the laws of the land. You can practice any religion you want. You can even make up your own. But as soon as your new church of vampirology starts mandating that you drink the blood of a 26-year-old virgin, you know what? I think then we have a problem. Your freedoms are always, always secondary to the rule of law. Except, it seems, when it comes to radical Islam, where Sharia trumps all. But in Europe, large Muslim communities, emboldened by their increasing numbers, are demanding that tenets of Sharia law be allowed to rule. The calls for Sharia are growing louder in countries such as Germany, Italy, Ireland, Britain, and the European Union. It's actually been proposed there that the laws of non-EU countries should be applicable in divorce cases within their own countries. That means Sharia could become legitimate civil law for Muslims in Europe, or at the very least, Muslim women may end up without any rights, even if they live in a so-called democratic country. The EU has also recently called for a name change when talking about terrorist acts performed by radical Muslims. Instead of Islamic terrorist, the acceptable term, at least at this time, is now terrorists who abusively invoke Islam. See the difference? I mean, other than length? Yeah, me neither. But it makes people feel better. And that apparently is what we're after. It's a great concept. Extremists use our political correctness to set up their own little enclaves within European cities and then create no-go zones for Western leaders and, in turn, Western law. When the Home Secretary of England made a visit to a predominantly Muslim community to speak last year, he was met with a heckler who asked, "How dare you come to a Muslim area?" Wow. You know what's really frightening? This isn't really a new phenomenon. The emergence of Islamic communities was encouraged way back in 1980, when the Islamic Council of Europe published the book Muslim Communities in Non-Muslim States, which outlined a strategic plan on how to avoid being assimilated into another culture. Here's how it works. First, concentrate yourself in large numbers within the community. 2, set up schools and mosques. 3, avoid being ruled by the majority. The ultimate goal is to gain large enough numbers so you eventually can take over and spread Islamic rule. Dr. Patrick Sokdio, the director of the Institute for the Study of Islam and Christianity, says, quote, "In a decade, you will see parts of English cities which are controlled by Muslim clerics and which follow, not the common law, but aspects of Muslim Sharia law. The fundamental rule of Islam in Europe is to never dilute your presence. Do not integrate." In the meantime, cities in Europe, particularly London and Paris, are seeing problems with large pockets of fundamentalist Muslims creating their own communities. Churches are being burned down. Street riots are almost common. Jewish students are being attacked. Schools are being forced to stop teaching about the Holocaust because it may, quote, be offensive. Halal meat is served in prisons, schools, and hospitals. Some districts in the London area have been forced to change their names if they sound too Christian. The Sharia Law Council for the UK
has pressured the country into providing mortgages and pensions under Sharia principles. And in December 2004, the National Audit Office agreed to overhaul the tax system because Muslims with more than one wife were being unfairly penalized. What the hell is happening to us? The UK Islamic Mission summed up the overall idea pretty well. Quote, "Establish Islamic social order in the United Kingdom in order to seek the pleasure of Allah," end quote. So long as the British stay asleep, Islamic social order is exactly what they're going to get. You know something? I think I could write an entire book about all the problems that the Frenchy French have. Not the least of which is the fact that the entire country smokes like a coal-fired power plant. But since I only have this one section, let's focus on the fact that over the last 20 years, France has essentially allowed the establishment of a separate Muslim state within its borders. ADD moment here. Simon & Schuster, if you're listening to this, consider that part about the Frenchy French my next book proposal. Here's the thing in France. Many Muslims in France think of themselves as Muslim, not French. According to the BBC, quote, 10 years ago, these rioting youths were seen as French Arabs. Now they're most commonly referred to and define themselves as Muslims, end quote. Scattered throughout France are hundreds of Muslim ghettos where poor, unemployed, angry young men live under a commitment to Islam, not democracy. In 1991, there were 106 of these no-go zones, or hot spots, as the Frenchy French authorities call them. By 2002, when they conveniently stopped counting, there were 818. The violence in some of these places is so out of control that the police often refuse to intervene. Unfortunately, that only helps to further segregate these enclaves from the rest of society. This boiling cauldron of anger and radicalized youths exploded in late 2005 when the riots broke out. In an effort to stop the attacks and distance them from Islam, France's most influential Islamic group issued a religious edict, or fatwa, condemning the violence. Quote, "It is formally forbidden for any Muslim seeking divine grace and satisfaction to participate in any action that blindly hits public or private property or could constitute an attack on someone's life," end quote. That's the fatwa, citing the Quran and the teachings of Muhammad. 9,000 burned police cars later, no one was listening, and it only gets worse. Segregation has spilled over in European schools, where previously unthinkable exceptions are now being made. The French Ministry of Education investigated 61 schools and found Muslim students refusing to dance, participate in sports, eat food that wasn't halal, prepared by Sharia law, draw a right angle. Believe it or not, they claim it looks like part of a Christian cross. They won't swim because, quote, they'd be polluted by infidels' water. Some Muslim students also refused to learn English or read certain books that offended them. In some schools, the students were even given separate toilets and showers so they wouldn't have to mix with the impure. A report titled, "Towards Greater Understanding, Meeting the Needs of Muslim Pupils in State Schools," was published earlier this year by the Muslim Council of Britain. It demanded that all un-Islamic activities be banned in school, including swimming lessons during Ramadan, opposite-sex contact sports, and Muslim students drawing people in art classes. It also encouraged religious curriculum, including teachings about Islam, as long as Muslims could opt out of any lessons regarding Christianity or Judaism. Europe, a mind is a terrible thing to waste. I guess I can only hope that your fall from grace, and I use the term grace loosely, will serve as a wake-up call for those of us with enough time to change our course. We've all heard the song, God Bless America. But most of us don't realize that there's actually a verse before the one we all know so well.
It goes like this. While the storm clouds gather far across the sea, let us swear allegiance to a land that is free. My friend, the storm clouds are gathering, all right. France is literally teetering on the edge. Our biggest ally, England, about to be turned inside out. If you think those clouds won't make their way across the Atlantic, you're dead wrong. They're already here. You just need to know where to look. Good place to start, the U.S. prison system. It's full of people looking for hope and purpose and redemption, and with a lot of time on their hands. It's a feeding ground for radicals seeking to marginalize moderate Muslims and convert those of other faiths. Wareth Dean Omar, he's the former chief Muslim chaplain in the New York State Department of Correctional Services. This guy was banned from setting foot in state prisons in 2003 when the Wall Street Journal reported that he said the 9/11 terrorists should be remembered as martyrs. Omar believes terrorism is accepted by the Quran. Quote, even Muslims who say they are against terrorism secretly admire and applaud the 9/11 hijackers. This is the sort of teaching they don't want in prison. But this is what I'm doing, end quote. New York Senator Chuck Schumer's office wrote, quote, Omar has wielded tremendous influence over the 45 or so clerics or imams that currently preach within New York's prison system, almost all of whom subscribe to his brand of Wahhabi extremism. Schumer himself, a guy I don't think I've ever agreed with, went further. In a letter to the head of the State Department of Corrections, he advocated the immediate firing of all imams hired under Omar's tenure. Quote, these imams represent a clear and present danger to the safety and security of New York State's prison system and indeed our entire country. I urge you to dismiss all imams hired under Mr. Omar's supervision and reconstitute the Muslim leadership inside New York State prisons to ensure that it reflects a more moderate brand of Islam that represents the diversity of belief within the Sunni, Shia, and Sufi sects that make up the Muslim community. End quote. Unfortunately, it doesn't look as the Department of Corrections listened. Maybe it'll take one of these prisoners doing something drastic before they actually start paying attention. And you know what's sad? This isn't just a New York problem. It's happening in prisons all across the country. And law enforcement is worried about it. FBI Director Robert Mueller told the Senate Intelligence Committee, prisons continue to be fertile ground for extremists who've exploited both a prisoner's conversion to Islam while still in prison, as well as their socioeconomic status and placement in the community upon their release, end quote. It's right out of a twisted math book. Thousands of young men, plus thousands of spare hours, plus dozens of radical clerics teaching them, equals bad news for America. All right, let's go here. Think of Phoenix. When you think of Phoenix, you probably think of sun and swimming pools and sand and heat. And, of course, the NBA team that's never won an NBA championship. All right, somebody wrote that for me. But Muslim extremists, just think of it as home. For more than 20 years now, they've been slowly migrating to the Phoenix area and opening schools and mosques that preach hate. Right after 9/11, a big, what did you know and when did you know it controversy broke out after an FBI memo surfaced in which it was clear that the government had knowledge of terrorists training with planes. That memo's title, The Phoenix Memo. Because it was written by the Phoenix branch of the FBI. It read, in part, Phoenix has observed an inordinate number of individuals of investigative interest who are attending civil aviation colleges in the state of Arizona. A few people known to be friends of Osama bin Laden were also known to reside there, and at least two of the 9/11 hijackers went to flight school in the area. The author of the memo, FBI agent Kenneth Williams, later testified in front of Congress that Islamic extremists may flock to Arizona because it reminds them of home, but they stay for the terrorist ties. Quote, these people don't continue to come back to Arizona because they like the sunshine and like the state. I believe something was established there, and I think it's been there for a long time, end quote. Later, the 9/11 Commission's report implicated Phoenix even further by referring to a CIA-FBI memo titled Arizona, the Long-Range Nexus for Islamic Extremists. I'd love to tell you about it, but that report is still highly classified. And then there are those crazy isolated incidents that someone far more conspiratorial than I might find interesting. In November 2006, Sisaya Chicha Dinsa, I'm guessing at the pronunciation, was stopped by Detroit police and found to be carrying $80,000 in cash and information about cyanide, nuclear power plants, and suitcase bombs. Oh, along with newspapers commemorating the 9/11 attacks. Oh, one more thing. He also had a handwritten note that said, quote, "This community is angry. Something is going to happen. We are going to see justice. This is a powder keg waiting to go off," end quote. Where was he flying? Phoenix. Or, wait a minute, how about this one? The Flying Imams. Remember these guys? They were detained after acting suspiciously like the 9/11 hijackers. Yeah. They were heading to Phoenix as well. Maybe that's part of the reason why Phoenix's Sky Harbor Airport is the first airport in the country to test the new backscatter security machines, the ones that critics say reveal a lot more than just weapons. It's not just a small amount of anecdotal evidence that points to Arizona as a hotspot. Most people associate Steve Jobs with the creation of Apple, even though Steve Wozniak was also a founder. Well, there's a similar dynamic here with our good buddies at Al-Qaeda. Osama bin Laden may get all the publicity, but Wael Gilaidan was the founding member. Oh, crazy thing, he was also the president of the Tucson Islamic Center in the mid-1980s. Our government implores citizens to speak out. See, you see something, say something. You see something suspicious, talk about it. But when that behavior involves sensitive subjects such as Islam, the good citizen is often dragged through the media as hateful, racist, phobic bigot. Well, how likely would you be to put your reputation on the line if you saw a few suspicious things at the airport, but had really nothing more than just a gut feeling that something was wrong? Right after 9/11, a woman in Florida at a diner became suspicious of some Muslim men huddled together looking as if they were up to no good, so she called police. Turns out, she was wrong. But our open-minded and compassionate media proceeded to drag the woman through the mud, commenting on her hairstyle and her accent. She was depicted as a backwoods, racist hillbilly. And then there's the infamous Flying Imams incident I touched on just now. I don't know about you, but if I get on an airplane and six fidgeting Muslims are griping about the United States at the gate, praying to Allah immediately before takeoff, asking for seatbelt extenders when none is needed, playing musical chairs once they're on board, you know what? I think I'm going to need a drink and a pair of new underwear. But the nervous passengers who turned them in were tarred and feathered in the media after the imams cried discrimination and said this proved America's racism and lack of understanding of Islam. Bull frickin' crap. How can you ask people to be the first line of defense against terrorism when every time they put up a red flag, they end up vilified? Are you only allowed to sound alarm bells if you're 100% sure that's what's going on? We're told to alert authorities if we see something suspicious. But if we're wrong about it, well, then we're the ones who wind up under the suspicion of racism. I am thankful there are still people willing to take that chance. Remember the New Jersey Circuit City employee who foiled the Fort Dix 6 terror plot? He noticed that the video he was transferring to DVD depicted jihad training, and by speaking up, he may have saved thousands of lives. But I think we all know what would have happened if he had been wrong.
Hello, ACLU.
In 2002, author Anis Shorish laid out what he said was Radical Islam's 20-point plan for undermining America, See how many of these sound familiar to you. 1. Terminate America's freedom of speech with statewide and nationwide hate crime bills. 2. Yell foul, out of context, personal interpretation, hate crime, Zionist, un-American, inaccurate interpretation of the Quran anytime Islam is criticized or the Quran is analyzed in the public arena. 3. Accelerate Islamic demographic growth via massive immigration, marriage, and prison conversions. 4. Use the American educational system to teach loyalty to the Quran and spread the dislike of Jews, evangelical Christians, and democracy. 5. Appeal to compassionate and sensitive Americans for sympathy and tolerance towards Muslims in America who are portrayed as mainly immigrants from oppressed countries. 6. Use riots and demonstrations inside prisons to demand Islamic Sharia as the way of life. 7. Open charities throughout the United States, but use the funds to support Islamic terrorism. 8. Send intimidating messages and messengers to the outspoken individuals who are critical of Islam and seek to eliminate them. But even more chilling is the supposed Al-Qaeda master plan. In his book, Al-Zarqawi, Al-Qaeda's Second Generation, Jordanian journalist Fawad Hussein lays out what he describes as a 7-phase, 20-year plan to establish an Islamic caliphate. That's a global state. Phase 1, the awakening. Wake up Muslims around the world by provoking the United States to attack the Islamic world. Check. 9/11 with its resulting wars in Afghanistan and Iraq. Pretty good start for this phase. Hussein wrote that Al-Qaeda considers this to be very successful and believes that its message is now being heard everywhere. Phase 2, opening eyes. This is likely the phase we're currently in. The idea is to turn the Islamic community into a movement by recruiting young men and making Iraq the central base of operations. Phase 3, arising and standing up. Attacks on Syria, Turkey, Israel, and possibly Jordan highlight this stage, which is hoped to make Al-Qaeda a more recognized organization. Phase 4, take over. With many Middle East countries facing terrorist attacks, Al-Qaeda's hope is to begin collapsing the governments of hated Arabic countries. Simultaneously, terrorists intend to attack oil infrastructure and suppliers and cripple the U.S. economy through cyber terrorism. Phase 5, caliphate. With weakened or toppled governments and decreased willingness of Western governments to intervene, an Islamic state can be created to bring about a new world order, end quote. Phase 6, total confrontation. A fight between the believers and the non-believers will be initiated by the new Islamic army. And finally, Phase 7, definitive victory, with 1.5 billion Muslims fighting. The Islamic army will defeat all others within 2 years, and the caliphate will stand. Although it's not included in Hussein's book, I really believe that extremists will begin to specifically target our children. Schools and school buses are not only easy targets, but the result of any attack on them would be nothing short of catastrophic. It would turn us into a nation of irrational nutjobs who, God forbid, would do insane things like torch mosques, and that is exactly what our enemy wants us to do. Yet, this is another way that our political correctness is killing us. If we were able to talk openly about this kind of stuff, it would reduce the chance of a severe overreaction happening. Unfortunately, we can't. At least without being called a racist or an Islamophobe. Whether or not the details of the plan are correct isn't the issue. The fact is, we all know the goal is accurate, because we've heard it from extremists over and over again throughout the Middle East. Can it work? Well, you can already see how Americans' attitudes have changed since 9/11, and with the war in Iraq, we just don't want to deal with this stuff anymore. But while we all put on our blinders and retreat, the terrorists are methodically plodding along, continuing with their long-term plan for our annihilation. If we don't wake up, then the answer is yes, it can work. Now my solution. When you combine everything happening around the world these days with the unbelievably specific plans of our enemies, things start to seem overwhelming. But it's not too late. This is a war we can and will win. Al-Qaeda may need 7 phases to establish their caliphate. I only need 4 to prevent it. Phase 1. Start calling evil by its name. No one can afford to be silent anymore. We all, Muslim, non-Muslim alike, must speak up and say enough. If we don't want our history, our culture, and likely our entire civilization to be completely destroyed, we must say enough. And you know what? Women need to take a lead on this. Where's the National Organization for Women speaking out against the fact that women in extremist societies are tortured? They're discriminated against, forced into arranged marriages, and not allowed access to education. Aren't they supposed to advocate and defend women's rights? Every woman in America, Oprah, hello, regardless of her religious beliefs, should stand up against this cruelty. And the rest of the world needs to encourage and empower women to do so. Oh, I love people who say, "Oh, Glenn, let's just sit down and talk to him. If we just understand them, they won't be so angry with us." Are you out of your mind? You don't debate Muslim extremists. They're simply not interested in your little chit-chat. The second you question motives or ask an honest question about Islam, you are automatically labeled as a racist or Islamophobe and compared to the Nazis. French writer Michel Houellebecq called Islam the stupidest religion. You know where he ended up? In court. Theo van Gogh made a 10-minute film about Islamic extremists and ended up dead. Ayaan Hirsi Ali, the former Muslim who fled Somalia and an arranged marriage, was targeted for death by Theo van Gogh's killer. She appeared on my show last year. I had an amazing conversation with her. I asked her, as a woman who has seen up close the transformation from moderation to extremism and experienced the hate that accompanies it, what she thought people needed to hear. Her answer was chilling. She said to me, quote, "For those people who say it's all a small problem, I want to tell them, it starts small, but it grows. When I was living in Africa, the first veils were remarkable. Now a country like mine in Somalia is entirely in the hands of people who want to introduce Sharia or Islamic law, which was just an unfathomable 20 years ago." End quote. Dr. Zudi Jasser, he's of the American Islamic Forum for Democracy. He's fighting to save his country, America, and his Muslim faith by speaking out. He rightly believes that the bulk of the fight will have to be undertaken by Muslims themselves. Quote, "We have to start understanding as a community that the only way to defeat this is to get back the moral courage of Islam, to declare that the Islamists are our enemies, and that we are Americans first and Muslims second. What gives us our freedom to be Muslims is our country." But what a surprise, Dr. Jasser is also a target. He was recently called a dog in an editorial cartoon in the Arizona Muslim Voice. He fired back at the publication saying, "It reeks of the tired and pathetic technique to vilify and demonize those who threaten their control the most, rather than to deal with the core issues they raise." Phase 2. Reinstate the First Amendment. Free speech must reign. For the love of Pete, people, it's America. Political correctness must die. It might seem like a trivial point when talking about extremism, but our country is headed down a very dangerous path if we all keep letting special interest groups, whether they're based on religion or not, become more important than the laws of the land. In its Cantwell decision, the U.S. Supreme Court wrote, quote, "The First Amendment embraces two concepts, the freedom to believe
and the freedom to act. The first is absolute, but the second cannot be. Conduct remains subject to regulation.